This is the New York Times Magazine for Sunday, the 29th of September, and this is Dave Abbott. This week is the Voyages issue to Points Unknown. Mostly photographs, unfortunately, this week. Dispatches from the extremities of the earth. I'm not sure I want to see some of those. At any rate, this is that does have some text in it, and I'm going to provide that, and occasionally a description of a photograph or two. But they are mostly archival photos. A lot of text is by Sam Anderson. What is it about human beings that makes us want to see the unseen? We go to extremes. Humans can hardly survive anywhere. It is both terrifying and comical how vulnerable we are. We live comfortably, sort of, under exactly one condition in the temperate patches of a very thin crust on a relatively small planet in a tiny corner of the known universe. Transport us anywhere else, and we will basically instantly die. Other planets will choke us. Black holes will crush us. Even our own modest planet's oceans will drown us, and its poles will freeze us, and its deserts will dry us into leathery husks. And yet, we still want to go everywhere. We seem especially drawn to the places that will hurt us the most. We want to wander through vast deserts in Namibia, where skeletons rival the living animals. We want to explore remote caves in Borneo for signs of humans who explored the caves before. We want to time travel, even if that only means leaping time zones. Some sinister voice in our psyche whispers that the real stuff is always farther out there, and then a little farther, and then even farther. Sometimes directly next to total annihilation. We find ourselves shimmying out again and again to stare into the face of our own doom. What are we supposed to do with this irrational yearning? Technology helps. These days, our screens allow us essentially to teleport all over the world. We can virtually walk the Great Wall of China or watch sea eagles sitting on eggs and nests near magnificent fjords. We can spin the whole planet around and zoom in wherever we want. Mauna Loa, Krakatoa, the Great Barrier Reef, the Giant's Causeway. As we look, we can almost believe we are there, but a real voyage, by most definitions, requires our actual bodies, and if the destination is sufficiently extreme, we may find ourselves making use of one of the most venerable technologies in the history of human innovation, the big, clunky suit. I'm talking about B-movie, Frankenstein's monster, stumbling and bumbling aggressively, inelegant, vaguely humanoid bubble wrap. Clunky suits are the modern version of knight's armor. Artificial shells designed to ferry us through alien zones. They are half clothing, half contraption. In order to stagger off into some interesting hellhole, we are willing to sacrifice comfort, aesthetic dignity, and the ability to move our limbs. We are willing to tolerate bystanders gawking at us and saying, "Really? A human is in there?" Clunky suits are the blunt instruments of voyaging. In a way, the clunky suit becomes its own voyage. We look at it and see the human imagination projecting itself across many different eras into the daunting extremes of the outside world. The images accompanying this text were pulled from the archive of the New York Times, and they're scribbled with dates and reference numbers, evidence of past generations staring at them with fascination, amusement, and wonder. Their publication dates range from 1919 to not so long ago. They are trapped in time, but also timeless as we look at them. In 1946, an Air Force pilot hunches awkwardly in a pressurized suit fitted with hoses and valves that allow him allegedly to survive at 62,000 feet, but it also looks as though it weighs 62,000 pounds. A swimming champion prepares to cross the English Channel in a suit that looks specifically designed to make swimming impossible. A diver wears an old Ford gas tank on his head. To navigate a world of snow, a man has not only encased himself in caribou fur, but has also donned driftwood sun goggles, a contraption so analog and elegant that it looks futuristic, like a Star Trek visor or a virtual reality headset. We should remember that although some clunky suits look ridiculously old-fashioned, they are by no means tools of self-preservation from the past. Modern astronauts geared up for space don't look all that different from their 1960s predecessors, and we hardly need to look all the way to outer space. An NFL player suited up for game day puts on armor as ridiculous as any medieval knight's. A woman selling honey at your local farmer's market probably handles her bees in an outfit that looks very much like an old-timey beekeeper of yore. Look at everyone who steps outside their houses between December and March in the nation's northern latitudes. A Minnesota man walking his dog in January bears more than a passing resemblance to an Arctic explorer in the 1920s. A big clunky suit, no matter how old-fashioned it may look, represents something eternal. It's the same desire that today makes us want to trudge into a vacant-seeming field in Virginia to see disintegrating presidents' heads. This instinct of exploration will long outlive the suits as well as the bodies they have protected, but the suits themselves will no doubt continue to arrive, and whether made of whalebone or space-age digital nanofibers, they will always represent something timeless, the insatiable human urge to explore. And we will stare at them and be inspired to go on farther and even farther until we have run out of places to go. And next, Bones in the Sand, featuring a photograph of a Namibian desert and a shipwreck on the shore. And it is all beach, all the way to the mountains, and these big, huge, rolling, drifted sand dunes. It's a striking image of sea and sand and sky. In the hulking detritus of West Africa's skeleton coast, a sobering testament to civilizational impermanence. This text is from Michael Finkel. The skeleton coast of southwestern Africa offers an epic view of an elemental struggle, raw, churning ocean in an endless tug of war against the indomitable march of desert sand. The word beautiful, it may not come to mind when voyaging here, though the name itself suggests beauty is wrong somehow. The shoreline, partly preserved in a 6,300 square mile national park, evokes a feeling perhaps better described as sublime, with all the attendant awe and grandeur and fear that the word implies. There are indeed skeletons, whale bones, some from the old hunting days, strewn like plane wreckage, as well as the bludgeoned hulks of cargo ships and fishing boats, possibly more than 1,000 of them, slain by a lethal combination of dense coastal fog and shallow rocky outcrops. It is a place ruled by fur seals and seabirds and the hardy saber-horned antelopes known as oryxes. Wind sculpts the sand monumentally. Miles of ripples, mountains of scalloped dunes. A starfish the size of a voting district. All of it constantly shifting and morphing. Travel here is often via small chartered airplanes, departing from towns that already seem perched at Earth's edge. Photographer Glenna Gordon ventured further than most, at times hiring a helicopter to reach remote wrecks. I flew out of Walvis Bay along with my family, buzzing over this seam between land and sea, feeling conflicted by the great expanse I'd incurred to see such primal nothingness in a part of the world where there's little wealth, rattled to my heart by the incomprehensible immensity. If the Skeleton Coast sounds unwelcoming, it's true. People don't really belong here. I had leapt continents, four-wheeled over washboard roads, hired bush planes, harnessing all I could of civilization's might, only to arrive in an area that made me feel insignificant and helpless. Sometimes we need such a kick to the hubris to be reminded of the planet's true balance of power. Witness the iron and steel-hulled ships subsumed by sand crumbling into rusty flakes. Humans often believe we can bend the world to our will, that our reign will be permanent. The Skeleton Coast offers a simple and powerful rebuttal. The first image is of a street sign, an old street sign. It has been completely washed by sand and wind and has been bleached by the sun, giving directions to no one in a part of the country that is essentially deserted. It says as much as you can, I suppose, about where you are, where you're going. You are nowhere, and you are going nowhere. Next, a shipwreck that has somehow found itself inland in the desert. The Edward Bolin II had crashed in 1909. Starting in 1891, the ship was used to bring mail from Germany to Western Africa. And later, after war broke out between the Germans and Hereros, it became a prison ship. In peacetime, it was refurbished as a passenger vessel, and it even found a use after it wrecked as a home for diamond miners. Another photograph, whale bones near Sandwich Harbor, migrated inland with shifting sands. Many whales washed up after World War II, but some skeletons that date from the 1800s are still visible, as are, on occasion, human bones, presumably the remains of miners and sailors. And another outline of a ship, still close enough to the beach that you can see the roiling waves in the distance. And the ship's origins and name are unknown. It is essentially flat to the sands, with just the outline appearing. It's just one of hundreds of vessels to have crashed along the coast, and you can see a jackal's footprints skirting the edge of the wreck. The next image is of a freighter, and it is just the skeleton of a freighter at the seashore. It was the Otavi. It was transporting guano to be used as fertilizer from Mercury Island when it ran aground in 1945. The wreckage remains in Spencer Bay, which is almost completely untouched by humans, but it is home to thousands of fur seals, and they are huddled in the distance in something resembling a beach blanket bingo. Next, images of presidents. It is their essentially busts of presidents. They look like they may be concrete. Heads of state, this piece is entitled. It's in Virginia, 150 miles south of Washington, D.C. It is a crumbling shrine to presidential history. The text is from Mark Leibovich, and the photographs are from Hannah Price. First image is of the backs of their heads. Some of them are cracked. Some have wigs. Some are obviously older than others. After driving down from D.C. to Croker, Virginia, I was greeted at the foot of a dirt driveway by no trespassing and do not enter signs. Up the driveway, 50 or so people were gathered before a burly guy in flip-flops, John Plachel, a local storyteller, and today our tour guide. There's only so much I can tell you about the whole experience, because this is private property, and things get a little complicated with legal and liability concerns. Look for him on the internet is all I can say. People love places that are falling down, Plachel told the group, and people really love being in places where they're not supposed to be. The place in question is a ragged industrial field that has become the repository for 42 giant busts of American presidents sculpted by an artist named David Adickes, each some 15 to 18 feet in height and 8 to 10 tons in weight. They used to inhabit something called President's Park in nearby Williamsburg. But after that place closed in 2010, the orphaned commanders in concrete were transported by flatbed to Croker, about 12 miles away. The brief but treacherous journey left the heads in various states of disrepair. Bill Clinton is missing part of his right ear. Woodrow Wilson looks as though he has leprosy. Ronald Reagan might have been struck by lightning. Abraham Lincoln has a hole in the back of his skull, as if he needed one of those. Following Plachel's directions, I walked past dumpsters and cones and barrels and porta-potties, dirt piles, construction equipment, two goats. Finally, arranged in rows amid the weeds and wildflowers and overgrown grass, there were the presidents. They loomed grand and vulnerable, stately and a bit sad. I kept stepping back to view them all together as a stalwart institution that has seen better days. The other explorers scattered, taking selfies, noting the sideburns on John Quincy Adams.
"I think the fat one back there is Martin Van Buren," I heard someone say.
Wandering around, I could not help wondering what it was like here at night when the flesh and bloods, like me, had gone. I imagined the concrete presidents reminiscing, murmuring about the decaying state of themselves and of things. On the next page, we have a close-up of five of the busts. In President's Park, we have the images are Chester A. Arthur's back of his head, Benjamin Harrison, Thomas Jefferson, Ulysses S. Grant, and the back of I'm not sure who that might be. I would guess it's one of the 20th century presidents, one with not a whole lot of hair. So I'm hesitant to say that it might be Truman. At any rate, they were created by a Houston sculptor. His name again, David Dickies, who was inspired after a trip to Mount Rushmore. We have on the next page an image, a close-up of George Washington, and another of Herbert Hoover, John Quincy Adams, Nixon, and Martin Van Buren. The Nixon has been it looks like somebody hit him with a water balloon full of paint. I don't know how else to describe it. It's some damage was done to him, but there we have it. In the next image, we have the images or the sculptures with a couple of kids, and they provide us with scale. I would think that these busts are at about maybe 30 times life size. So they are imposing, definitely. And some of the images are almost photographically rendered. They're that striking and precise. We have presidents Hoover, Nixon, Carter, Kennedy, Coolidge, Wilson, Lyndon Johnson, Taft, Theodore Roosevelt, and Arthur, and they are between 15 and 18 feet tall. Oh, except Barack Obama is rendered in concrete, but he's in miniature, and he's like 2 feet tall. So he was the current president. I wonder if there's a political message intended there. I don't know. Next, deep in the darkness, far beneath the rainforest floor in a pair of remote national parks lie some of the world's oldest signs of human activity in Borneo. And this text is by Jake Nevins. Scientific expeditions have plumbed the vast limestone caves of Borneo ever since the naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace began writing about them in the mid-1800s. The accounts by Wallace, who speculated about the possibility of discovering prehistoric human remains within the caves, inspired Britain's Royal Society to help fund an expedition there in 1878. In the resulting report, Alfred Hart Everett describes finding pottery fragments, a Neolithic stone axe head, and the remains of people who had already reached an advanced stage of civilization. As a result, he declared no light has been thrown on the origin of the human race. Less than a century later, however, archaeologists working in a different cave recovered a fragmentary human skull that appeared to date from the late Pleistocene era. Last year, scientists who had explored yet another Borneo cave in 1996 determined that a red image of a four-legged creature, seemingly a banting, a species of Southeast Asian cattle, is the oldest known figurative art in the world. It was hand-painted onto the limestone at least 40,000 years ago, according to estimates, or some 8,000 years before the famous pictures of rhinos and lions in the French cave in Chauvet. The island of Borneo is almost entirely divided between Indonesia, where the picture of the Banteng was found in Lubang Jerege Saleh cave, and Malaysia, whose caves in Naya National Park and Gunung Mutu National Park are tourist destinations. The photographer Olaf Otto Becker visited both parks. Though he saw no relics of ancient humans, living things were abundant. Cave crickets, crabs, cockroaches, spiders, and block nest swiftlets in burrows overhead. And, of course, bats. As many as 3 million of them are thought to live in Gunung Mulu Deer Cave alone, the single largest cave passage in the world. They're not very satisfied when you come into the cave with a bright flashlight, Becker says. They get very nervous. At dusk, he got to see them leave en masse, another reminder of the wonders within the caves, on their nightly search for food. The sky was filled with snake-like petals, he said, a never-ending bat cloud in the form of a snake. And the first image is of stalagmites, and they're referred to as jellyfish. And in 1966, an archaeological team led by Tom and Barbara Hansen excavated groups of bones that suggested the stretch of the Naya caves called Labang Hangus was used 13,000 years ago for discarding the remains of hunted animals. The cavern itself is clearly immense. The steps and the size of humans would suggest that it is several hundred feet high, all underground, and massive rock structures. At the end of Labang Talang, sunlight becomes a blinding spotlight to those accustomed to the darkness. To visit the far reaches of the cave system, visitors leave wood-planked pathways behind and trek over rock in complete darkness. And the image is of the light, the darkness, and the green plants that can grow in the light but find their way into the darkness for the sake of safety. The Hansons discovered a so-called deep skull, an anatomically modern human skull between 30 and 40,000 years old, in the Naya Great Cave in 1958. Its expanse, the entrance, is 500 feet high, and the light levels within made photography difficult. It's so dark in the center of the caves that most of the tourists will fail to see what I captured with the photograph. I like technical challenges like this. And we have immense green structures on the walls and on the ceiling, I guess you'd call it. I can't tell if they're lichen or if they are mineral deposits or quite what, but it almost looks like a rendering of Welsh countryside in nighttime, and yet it is in this massive cavern. That's pretty much all my time for today. This is Dave Abbott, and this has been the New York Times Magazine. Thanks so much for listening.